We are going to finish up with Locke with a few reflections on what we've already heard of him and what I've commented on. You might wonder, with all these missteps and holes and faux pas and so on, why we read Locke. And the answer is that Locke made some real progress for philosophy. Instead of being caught in that rationalist network and having to assume that the rational order of math and logic was the very fabric of reality, he wants to take matter as really existing. There are really external objects outside our minds, that we have perceptions of them that are inside our minds, that are not physical objects but sensory bundles of sights, tastes, touches, sounds, and smells. And by taking us back to experience is an emphasis in the direction that the sciences had been going for two centuries or so already. We're not just going to spin ideas of a fantasy world and say, this must be real because there's no contradiction in it. If we want to know what reality's like, we're going to go out and look. And the inconsistencies are troubling from a philosophical standpoint, but in some cases, they're encouraging. He says all we have in our mind is sensations and concepts, and they don't have physical properties, and the external world has only physical properties. And I said, well, then how could one be the copy of the other? And the answer is, if they're thought of that way, they can't be. But it can't be that what we have is a copy of what's outside our minds. But Locke doesn't get all worked up about that kind of stuff. He just goes on to the next problem. And in that way, he comes out to be championing a kind of common sense view of the whole mess. He wants to say, look, there's a real world. We perceive the real world. We form concepts. We try to explain the real world. We try to explain how our minds work. Then he gets somewhat mixed up about that too, because first he says there's nothing in our minds but sensations and concepts, and then he says we have an intuitive grasp of our minds and how they work without being able to form a concept of them, and we certainly don't perceive them as objects. It would make no sense to ask Locke, what color is your mind, for example. But Locke doesn't get too worked up. It goes on anyway. You could say he leaves these things that he left unsolved, he leaves these problems to his successors. Here you are, guys. Here in the outline, there's the big picture. I think it's basically right, and these little glitches inside, you work it out. But in that way, he's doing more what science does in this time. 1600s. Investigating, trying to set up experiments, coming up against conundrums they can't explain, just holding everything in abeyance, awaiting more information, and so on. So they're more like one another. Whereas when the rationalists get done, they've got a world that's nothing like the one that we experience and live in every day. But Leibniz is a good example. So a great thinker logically and so on. He invented the infinitesimal calculus. But his ontology is about things called monads, all of which, down to the tiniest ones, the monads of dust and dirt particles and atoms, are all conscious. I can't think of a single reason for believing that, except that he can't explain how life and consciousness arise later if it isn't in the original material. And just because he can't think of it doesn't mean that isn't what happened. And when he gets done, the picture of reality that he leaves you with is utterly foreign to everyday experience. And the average person says, so? I mean, what do I care? I don't. Monads are windowless. We're all locked in ourselves, and all we experience are states of ourselves. That's not what I experience every day. When I go out, it's self-evident to me that there are roads and trees and horses and in fields, stuff like that. And I think that common sense view is right, and I think that normal sense perception is self-evident. And we'll deal with self-evidency in some detail later on. Well, I think it means that Locke, in his typical kindly way, commends to us these things to think about, said, gives us his reflections, and leaves it to us. And it's not consistent, but after all, our present science isn't either. Maybe they're in the same boat, and we'll sort them both out by more investigation of the world around us. I think he commends that to us. And I find then that he hit on a lot of things that are right and need to be seconded and endorsed, and then messed them up pretty badly as well. Did both. Now, the next thinker that we're tackling is more precise and ingenious in the arguments that he produces. I'm going to read a number of them to you because there's no better way to convey what he was doing. George Berkeley is a young man who decided to go into the ministry in the Church of England, was ordained, and eventually became a bishop in the Church of England as that church existed in Ireland, hostile territory. But Berkeley took the side of the Irish in that controversy. And he, in many letters and postings, sided with the Irish against the English treatment of them. That's one thing. And for another thing, Berkeley became convinced that the reason most people are atheists is that they're materialists. They think everything is physical. And the physical world has been here forever. It just always was. You're right, something self-existent. But it's not an ethereal being, much like us, called God. It's matter and energy in space. And the modern version of that, not of Berkeley's day, but of our own, is to say there was space, quantum gravity, some potentiality for matter, and that's all you need. They go to town, they make the universe that we now know. Berkeley didn't know about quantum gravity or any of the other things the way they're now known, but he thought he heard atheists speaking. And the people that rejected all religion, in his view, the atheists, were very careful to guard themselves if they were inclined to philosophical thought or to debating the issue. And they made it clear that the self-existent reality is matter and energy. Or maybe matter, energy, and space. And it's governed by a couple of rules. Maybe it is gravitation and something else. But that's it. And so those people, a century later, would welcome Darwin's theory and claim that that all happened just by natural effect of the laws on matter and energy. Darwin himself didn't accept his theory that way, you know. He writes, when we consider how the laws for matter are impressed upon it by their creator, We can say the same thing about individuals. Individuals are all born by the will of God, but through the secondary means of sexual reproduction. Why not then say that species are all created by God, but through the natural means of selection? So, at least when he made the theory, Darwin believes in God, or at least acknowledged that belief in God was able to be reconciled with what he's putting forward. I don't want to jump too much ahead. We're going to do, at the end of this course, a brief overview survey of the 19th century. We'll cover Darwin, and then a brief overview of the 20th century. I was asked by the director to put those at the end of this course, so the director says we need overviews. We're going to get overviews. But for now, I wanted to just tick off again the last contrast I was making between Locke and Kuyper, and then go in, dig right into George Berkeley. Here's what I had written down for you. Let's go through it, since my handwriting is, I've been told, so awful. Locke wants a laissez-faire view of the state. These are two French words that mean let it be, or let it make what it wants. This means for Locke that the state is not an inquisitorial state, such as was set up by Spain. The Inquisition means that a court sits in order to adjudicate cases of crime, and heresy was a crime. And it does so actively. It finances investigations into the public to locate and identify crimes and prosecute them. The idea of a court as that exists in Britain and the United States, for example, today, is that it's not an inquisitorial court. The court is passive. The court sits and does nothing unless it's petitioned by some citizens to correct an alleged wrong. So the court doesn't run the investigation. The police run the investigation of someone accused of a crime. And then there's a hearing to determine whether there's enough evidence to accuse the person formally and go to trial. I speak here of the now. I slipped from Britain and America to just America. But in any case, it's a laissez-faire court. It's a court that lets things be until it's petitioned to do something. Locke thought that the whole of government ought to be like that. After all, the government, in his view, is no more than a private security company, right? It's only for members. And the taxes go only to enforce the law and protect them from foreign invasion. So it's not the state's business to seek out crimes. It's the citizens' business to report them. And then the state may do an investigation and may try someone or not. But it has only to do with economics and property. Remember Locke's remark, if there's no property, there's no injustice. Granted, he used property in a much wider way than we do. We use it to mean possessions, but he uses it to mean anything that a person can in any sense possess. So it can be my private ideas, my plans, it can be my body, my life. I possess my own life in Locke's view usage of that term. So anybody that takes anything that's not theirs but is my property, they have committed an injustice. I should bring that before the state, and it will have courts that will decide whether this accusation has enough evidence to accuse the person, bring the person to trial. They have a trial, and then the person is found guilty or innocent, and if guilty, punished. That's to his mind what he wants by laissez-faire court. So that sounds good, doesn't it? Shouldn't that be part of the sphere sovereignty view too? And Kuyper doesn't want to say yes to that. We want the courts to to be laissez-faire, but not the entire government, is his answer. If an institution in one sphere of life fails, the government may have to step in and fulfill the failed institution's duty. So the government stands ready to step in emergency situation, and it has to read the emergency situation. It can't just be that it's petitioned, it's passive and it's petitioned. It has to keep an active eye on the entire society of which it is the agency and the institution of public justice. So for example, I give an example. It has to provide a safety net for the poor, for example. In a failed economy, the government may distribute food for it. And it's obligatory that it pass laws which will lead to economic recovery. But it may not wholesale take over the economy, especially it may not take it over permanently. That's Marx's solution. But this sphere of sovereignty is not Marxism. So the government doesn't devise the economy and put it on the people by force. It encourages the economy by laws intending for the economy to recover, and then it helps to preserve and support it, even if a safety net measure needs to be taken as to distributing food to the citizens who would otherwise starve. Kuiper made that point about more than once, and with respect to different institutions. He had it that if other institutions failed, the government could step in temporarily and do as much as it could to fulfill that place. But he does not want that government to stay that way. He wants the government then to do as much as possible to restore and revive the failed institution and have it continue to take its rightful place in this multiplicity of spheres of life and institutions to preserve and promote the spheres. I think Kuiper's gone a long way to giving us something different. All the views of the state prior to Kuiper's idea are hierarchical, and whether they're monarchical or democratic, whether the authority is automatically top-down or it's by election from the bottom up, it's the whole of society that is governed by the state. So what the state is that it is being objected to by him is the totalitarian state. The state governs the entirety of a society, not only every individual, but all the institutions in that society. All institutions are subject to the state. The sphere sovereignty view, I'll just put SS, the sphere sovereignty view has it that all other institutions have a relative autonomy. With respect to the state, government can exercise its proper authority and go into another state, another institution, into the realm of another institution if a crime's being committed there. That's the business of the state. The law is being broken. It has every right to go in. It has an obligatory duty to go in. So I can't murder a repulsive family member in the privacy of my home and then say to the state, you can't come in here. I mean, this is private. This isn't public. No, that's not the sense in which it's committed to public justice. public there means with public effects. So if I slight a child and give them a smaller piece of cake, it is private. We're not calling the police on that. But harm the child, you call the police. And it's a matter of public justice. And it falls under the sphere of the state to adjudicate and punish. As I say, Kuyper didn't live at the same time as Locke, but Locke has so beautifully stated the hierarchical view that I wanted to contrast it to what I take to be a more Christian view now, because we've got Locke giving a clear statement of the hierarchical view. So, sphere sovereignty is taught by Kuyper, and I put him, I told you, he lived from 1837 to 1920, but it's around the end of the 19th century and into the beginning of the 20th that Kuyper gets a chance to put sphere sovereignty into practice as Prime Minister of the Netherlands. All right, that, as far as I'm concerned, finishes up our study of Locke's philosophy. What direction they push things for coming thinkers. And now we're ready to start Berkeley, George Berkeley. I've already told you some introductory stuff about him. He was a bishop in the Church of England in Ireland. Tough assignment, I would think. But he did so while favoring very strongly the Irish cause. He wrote a number of essays condemning the English for the way they treated the Irish, and so he didn't get any equivalent to crosses burned on his lawn. He had good relationships with the Irish, whether they were in his church or they were Roman Catholic. He's more concerned with people who are atheists, who want to think there is no God. He's looking at the philosophy that's being written. No doubt he read Descartes. No doubt he read Locke. And what comes across to him is this idea that what we directly experience are not objects outside ourselves, but objects in here, in our minds. In there are colors, sounds, tastes, tastes, touches, and smells. And they come in bundled. This kind of bundles a table, this kind of bundles a vase with flowers in it, this kind of bundles a chair, and that bundle over there is an old lady. The bundles come in and we know them. Now, why then are some people still resistant to the doctrine of God and the gospel of Christ? He's a sincere Christian, there's no question. And what he wants to say, I'll read to you in his own words. All the monstrous systems of atheists have relied on the alleged existence of a material substance and the difficulty of understanding how it could be created out of nothing by God's command. His experience is the people who say they're atheists, those people, all, maybe not all, this may not be true of all, but all the ones he knew, all of them claim they're materialists. And they don't see how God could create matter out of nothing. That's the doctrine that's known in Christianity as the doctrine of creation. Ex nihilo. Latin for out of nothing. Let me try to make these as clear as I can. By matter, they don't just mean that there are objects outside of us that have physical properties, such as weight, mass, density, solidity, charge, specific gravity, we can go on. Any property that's related to another property by physical laws. They mean to say that those objects outside of us have only physical properties. They don't have any other kind. In philosophy, a materialist isn't somebody who believes get all the wealth you can. That's an ethical materialist. But a materialist in ontology, remember in theory of reality, is someone who says that reality itself has only physical properties and is governed by only physical laws. And that's what Berkeley's talking about here. But people that say that they're atheists reject all religion and they claim that they're materialists, that it's matter and energy that is self-existent. Remember the backward A means existence. And generates all. Sorry about that. I hit the wrong thing. Let's put it down again. A materialist is someone who believes all reality has only physical properties and is governed by only physical laws. Now, I'm going to point out something right away. That's a pretty hard position to maintain. If you claim there really are no logical laws, how are you going to argue for that? How are you going to attack other views and say, no, these are false? False isn't physical property. How are you going to tear apart somebody else's argument and claim that he has fallacies and he's made invalid inferences if there are no logical laws? So a lot of people are atheists who hold not only materialism in this strict sense, but are dualists. They believe there are two kinds of properties, and they're going to add math and or logic to the materialism. So, all things, according to the dualistic view, all things have only physical properties, but there are in the world logical properties that govern those things too. So they are physical logical or physical slash mathematical, so that we have a way of calculating about material things. We can actually do physics. I mean, if things have only physical properties and governed by only physical laws, there's no science of physics, because there are no logical inferences, no reasons that support a conclusion. So a lot of people are still atheists, though they are dualists, and the strict materialist who makes this claim here, are fewer, but they still exist. And I mean, they existed into the late 20th century, and there are some that still exist today. Okay. Let's put both these down for Berkeley. He wants to say that these are the reasons for being atheist. And he can show that these are false because he's going to argue. Are you ready for this? He's going to argue there are no such things as physical objects. That's not a way I would have thought of going at the atheist. I would want to give the atheist a chance to read scripture and see if it, by the testimony of the Spirit, strikes him as being true, the truth about God from God. It was kind of do it yourself or find the truth out for yourself kind of thing. But if I were going to try to make an argument, I don't think I'd start by trying to disprove there are physical objects, because I think there are. They're around me all the time. They're not exclusively physical. It's not that any of them have only physical properties, but almost all the things I see around me have physical properties. This book, the tablet that's working as my blackboard, chair I'm sitting in, the books over my shoulder here. But Barclay's going to show there are physical things at all. And that's surely startling, but I assure you he came up with ingeniously clever arguments. And one of the things that characterizes his philosophy is that he was so young when he achieved this. He was about 25 or only a few years older when he started to write this stuff. And that's unusual in philosophy. Mentioned that before. A lot of philosophers have commented on it too, beginning with Plato, that it takes people a while to live with their theory and in their theory and see the holes, the flaws, the weak points, and then what could be done about it, and it usually arrives at old age. And I think that, as you know, that there's a Christian philosophy. Was worked out by Professor Dooyeweerd in brilliant detail. So I don't think Dooyeweerd was an exception, but George Barclay was. And he gave really clever arguments, and I'm going to start by reading some of them to you. Not great long passages, but long enough so you get the... He says all the monstrous systems of atheists have relied on the alleged existence of material substance and the difficulty of finding out how it could be created by simple command of God. The supposed existence of matter has made it easier for impious and profane persons to deride immaterial substance, to deride the idea that minds or souls are realities that are not physical. To suppose the soul is divisible and corruptible like the body, to deny providence and to attribute the whole series of events to blind chance or fatal necessity. So, this is what the atheist said. If only we could get rid of matter, the atheist will lack the color of an empty name to support his impiety. But how can we get rid of matter without denying the validity of all of science? And that's how Barclay approached this problem. Can I do two things? Get rid of an external physical world. Keep physics and astronomy. So he started out by arguing concerning the primary and secondary substances. I'll remind you of this in this way. Primary. Secondary. Qualities. All right? This is a distinction first been proposed by Galileo, and it was taken over by Descartes, and it occurs in Locke, not in these terms, he gives other names. But let's put it down the way Galileo cooked it up first. Primary qualities are the physical properties, weight, mass, solidity, density, being a solid, liquid, gas, or plasma. Being subject to physical laws, such as the second law of thermodynamics, that everything by itself, everything gains in entropy. So unless it's acted on by an external force, everything tends to fall apart, tends to disintegrate, tends to cool off in physics. It's subject to other rules as well, the laws of gravitation and so on. Secondary qualities are qualities such as red, warm, smooth, wet, smells, sulfur, you know, the rotten egg smell. So it appears to have a color, and it is warm or cold. That's tactile sensation. Smooth and wet is tactile. It has smells. It has tastes. And it results in sounds registering in our ears. Now, in some cases, the person, the dualist, wants to hold that both sides of this are true, holds that the primary qualities are true of our bodies and the secondary qualities are true of our souls or minds. That's the way the dualist does it. And for Galileo and for Descartes, as you well know, they endorse dualism. That's right, that's the best we can do. So we have both sets of qualities. But remember, the secondary qualities are not out there in the world true of things that have these properties. And those properties, those primary properties, give rise to, cause, the secondary ones. So in the dualist scheme of things, if the primary qualities are all physical, and they somehow cause minds to see colors and hear sounds and have a feel of surfaces that are smooth and tastes and so on. All the senses. That's what the dualists wanted to say. What Berkeley is going to do here is claim that there's a number of claims. One is there's no good way for this stuff here, the primaries, to cause these. That if we introspectively examine the contents of our minds, we will find only these. And then the cruncher is that he analyzes these terms, all the terms that we use for the primary qualities, and he finds that if you analyze them, you find that these are terms for bunches of the secondary qualities. And in that case, there really are no primary qualities. There are only secondary ones. And the entirety of reality becomes what registers in minds. So in his ontology, he ends up with God, human minds, and the perceptions in those minds that God gives to them. And why do the perceptions agree with one another? I'll use that term, agree. When I look over there, I see a door. When you look over there, you see a door. And somebody else far away looks over there, they see a door in a distance. Why is that? God sees to it. So that's what we mean by an object. We mean all the sensations that God gives to all the minds. And that's what he does. He keeps it orderly. We all look over there, we all see a door. We all look over here, we all see a wall. Over my shoulder, books. God coordinates them. And why? Just why couldn't an all-powerful, all-knowing God do that? You want to tell me that he can't create perceptions in minds and perceptions in minds? Why can't he do that? Yeah, I can just see Barclay. Just give me a good reason why an omnipotent, all-powerful being couldn't do that. Which part of omnipotence do you not get? So we're going to look at his arguments and we're going to take them very seriously. And I said I will read them to you. There's a progression in them. He doesn't see this view all at once. He arrives at it gradually. And by the time he lays it out, it's a cruncher. If you say to a materialist, as this is what he does, what do you mean by solidity? Just take that physical property. And the materialist answers, well, if two things are solid in physics, then if you crash them together, neither can pass through the other without disrupting it. That's part of what we mean. Oh. So you have the sight of one thing, right? The visual sight of one thing and the visual sight of another, and the visual sight of crashing them together, and one can't go through the other without destroying it. Those are all sights, are they not? They're all visual sensations in your mind. Of course, you can also feel that an object is solid. But isn't that one sight hits another sight? Plus, where it hits my fist, I get tactile sensations too, of resistance, and it makes a certain sound. Now, if you take away the visual sights, the sounds, the tactile sensations, what's left of the idea of solidity? Now you have materialists scrambling. And he goes through one physical, allegedly physical property after another and shows that they all reduce to bundles of sensations. And everybody has been conceding for 200 years or more that sensations exist only in minds. There you got the theory of reality. Reality consists of God, human minds, and the sensations God gives to minds. It's a very extreme view, but there are some very clever arguments for it. And you may be relieved to hear that they don't work. There certainly is a reply to Barclay. But we'll see all of that when we come back next time. We're going to engage him as fully as we can. That's on the docket for our next lesson. And I'll see you then.